Welcome to How to Save the World. I'm Waveney Worth, and today I don't have Tim with me because we've got two awesome guests and we, you know, didn't want to be crowded out. So it's a huge privilege today to have the dearly loved zero waste giants of Aotearoa with us in the studio today, Hannah and Liam.
Kia ora! Yeehaw.
Hello, Waveney.
You may know these guys from a Reducing Household Rubbish talk. How many have you guys done?
Over 400.
What? Yeah,
including our school talks
yeah,
and all that.
Yeah, but, yeah. Wow. And over how many years?
Nearly three. Although we sort of count the early ones we did before we went on the rubbish trip,
But you've been on the road, you know, for 3 years,
yeah.
No
yeah.
house, no Almost. Home.
Yep.
But what you see with these guys is the tip of the iceberg. This is just by way of introduction. What have you guys worked on or working on currently? You've got the Product Stewardship Council.
Yeah, so I'm coordinating the Product Stewardship Council, which is more looking at how to put greater responsibility on manufacturers to reduce waste. And
we're
Liam.
both members of the Aotearoa Plastic Pollution Alliance on the board. I'm the co-chair or deputy chair. Sorry, I'm not that important.
you guys are involved in campaigns. You've got the Takeaway Throwaway campaign.
Yes,
the Caliwoods petition I saw recently.
Yes, Hannah did a lot of work to support that.
And you guys have both worked with Wastemans, with councils around New Zealand, Ministry for the Environment. Hannah and Liam, you guys have just had your panel discussion with Associate Minister for the Environment, Eugenie Sage.
Yep.
So you are across it. What else? Regional shopping guides?
Yeah.
Yeah.
part of the rubbish trip. So as we travel around ranting about waste, we also produce resources to help people reduce waste. So we create these regional shopping guides to point people towards all the local places where they can get zero waste stuff.
Incredibly. We've shouted out to them a couple of times before on this podcast. Well done. The best resource of its kind in New Zealand.
Oh, thank you.
And what else?
Well, I'd like to say I'm not really part of this network, but I would like to be, and I'm weaseling my way in there, but the Urban Farmers Alliance,
yes,
which just do amazing stuff with For the Love of Bees, is a weird kind of few organizations involved there, but
well, there you go, that's it, your shout out to you. Liam's looking for a shoulder tap, right?
Yeah, well, they're amazing. Okay,
and there's been the Regeneration Not Incineration campaign as well. That's huge. We did our Waste Energy podcast on that a few months ago. Yeah. It's just so important to we get the right messages there. Landfills aren't great, but incineration is really not great. And Hannah, what were you doing in lockdown?
Well, during lockdown, there were so many different things. We started a whole social media series of posts around resilient and resourceful zero waste. So encouraging people to make the most of being locked in their homes and not feel like they can't reduce waste, but be resilient and resourceful with what they have around them. So we were doing all kinds of things like darning and growing food out of salvaged seeds, and we had lots of successes and lots of failures. And we also, during lockdown, behind the scenes with the different alert levels, it was very unclear whether zero waste grocers were going to be allowed to operate, whether cafes and hospo were going to be allowed to accept reusable cups and containers and all that kind of thing. At alert level three. So we were doing a lot of work behind the scenes of talking with MPI, the Ministry of Health and so on, and also linking in with international groups around the world who are looking at the safety of reusables and talking with microbiologists and virologists around whether reusables are safe in these times, which they are. There was a lot of flurrying of activity around that.
There's been such an interesting sort of development in this whole pandemic situation, because it's happening differently all around the world as well. And I think much like New Zealand's response to COVID-19, we've actually also a positive beacon for what's possible with, reusables. So compared to people like the CDC in the US who are basically saying use disposable everything and don't accept people's own cups and containers.
Well, again, thank you on behalf of us all for that work you did. I know when we caught up just a few days ago to talk about this episode and try and understandably, when you hear that list, try and narrow down, okay, what are we actually going to really focus in on today out of all of these things? And I remember saying, oh, you know, hasn't lockdown actually been quite nice in terms of that regenerative slower pace? And that's when I found out, like, what you guys have been doing basically on my behalf, all this behind the scenes stuff to lobby or to find information about the reusables and all this stuff that we don't even, zero waste community and other, you know, sustainably minded communities in New Zealand are wanting to know this stuff. And then you're just suddenly, like, your blogs and things, you're incredible there with your information on what suddenly we can do or not do. And I always wonder how you know all this stuff, but it's like, well, actually, there's a lot of hard work going on. Yeah.
There was a lot of learning, I think, for us from lockdown, because we've been traveling around New Zealand for several years now, supporting people to live a zero waste or close to zero waste lifestyle within the current system that we have. And so a lot of it is kind of working around the edges, finding places like bulk bins that where things are unpackaged and all this kind of stuff. And it's totally possible to do it in ordinary times. But what we found with the government shutting down heaps of businesses, which they had to, you know, we totally supported the lockdown. But the assumptions about what businesses should stay open and what kind of practices were and were not okay, it was really interesting to see that falling back on major supermarkets, falling back on shutting down bulk bins without really thinking about it. And I guess it made us realize the importance of doing this work to look at some of these systemic issues, because if you know, like, a lot of the stuff that we've done, I guess, is empowering individuals to navigate the system without producing waste. But when all of those things fall down on the edges and you're left with only wasteful options, it makes you realize that zero waste hasn't been very resilient, I suppose.
Interesting. We two things before we get much further. One is to introduce our topic that we've landed on for today, which we all felt, you guys as well as Tim and I, felt that it was a fantastic synergy between our podcast and your kaupapa, and that's exploring the connections between individual action and systemic issues, because we're all about connecting people with their power to make a difference, but then, you know, not having that co-opted by other narratives of sort of like, it's the individual's fault, that, you know, just there's a difference between having the power to do something and saying that therefore it's your fault.
Yes, it's a very fine line, eh?
It's a fine line.
We were talking about it before too, of like, there's historically been a sort of a blame put on individuals for littering and for, you know, it's our responsibility to recycle and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's so interesting, so how, like, these things have happened.
Balance that with, well, actually, there are things we can do that tie into the bigger picture.
Yeah. Before we get into that, I've got a surprise for you guys. And it's just to do with a bit of a taitoko to you. And I felt that you have just been so tirelessly working for so long in this kaupapa around zero waste in Aotearoa. And I really have sensed from getting to know you that you guys don't necessarily clock your own significance, I think, for us all in the movement, I guess, in zero waste in Aotearoa. And so I have taken a liberty of asking some leaders to express their thoughts.
Interesting.
And
intrigued.
I'm just going to take a moment to share some of these thoughts with you guys, just to, I guess, show the love that we all have for you.
My God, you're gonna make me cry.
I haven't started.
No, it could be terrible. It could be fine.
Just push the mic away.
Tricia Farrelly, Product Stewardship Council, has said it's hard to find anyone else in Aotearoa with such a deep, complex and holistic understanding of waste, from policy, legislation, strategy, community recycling, individuals and businesses. Aotearoa would not have the government's current waste work program without the awareness raising and pressure on government from folk like Liam and Hannah. Love to you both.
Kia
ora, Tricia.
Kate Hall from Ethically Kate. New Zealand's zero waste movement wouldn't be where it was today without you. I'm honoured to know them as friends and work alongside them through Takeaway Throwaways.
Kia ora, Kate.
Rick Thorpe, Extreme Zero Waste Raglan, board member of Aotearoa's Zero Waste Network. I love the way you guys strip back the info so everyone can understand the craziness of waste. You've spent a huge amount of your own time traveling the length of the country, inspiring and learning. Huge mahi from the team. We look forward to catching up soon. I'm not going to be able to. I put the full on Facebook, but I'm not going to be able to shout out to everyone who has actually shouted out to you guys. But Miriama Kamo. Kia ora, Hannah and Liam. You've been my guiding lights. Thank you for your unwavering commitment to Papatūānuku and all that she sustains. I absolutely love the talks you guys give. Is it bad that I particularly love the snacks that you bring?
No.
I lose any sense of propriety around your green pesto dip, chickpea flour crackers, and delicious bliss balls. If you haven't seen me at any talks lately, that's partly why. There's only so many food-motivated, snack-crazed journalists anyone should have to battle around the table with. Anyway, enough about food. Back to you. You are powerful voices in what has been for too long a marginalised discussion. I'm grateful for your advocacy, your care, and your passion for our planet. I continue to be inspired by you every day.
Oh, that's so sweet.
That's beautiful.
Kei te mihi nui, kia korowa.
Kia ora, Miriama.
Kia ora.
I'm going to call it there. I'm just going to, there's others, actually just so heartfelt, but I'll flick you the full and online. And just to finish with what's almost a poem written especially for you by Leo Murray of Why Waste.
Leo.
You are seen, cornerstone of movement. You are heard, catalyst for change. You are loved, generosity of heart. You are appreciated, integrity of thought. You are true, grounded in action.
Wow.
Oh. Leo.
Stunning. Stunning.
And from myself, I'm hugely appreciative of the friendship, the practical advice, the last minute phone calls, you behind the scenes advisors for the show, best resources, I think, in New Zealand for Zero Waste Movement, and also incredible promotion partners for this podcast. You know, whenever you guys flick out a shout out, you see the spike in the numbers.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
Thank you, Waveney.
Yeah, kia ora.
That's so thoughtful.
We do have to say that it was you, Waveney, and your husband, Matthew, who really inspired us when we started our journey back in 2015. We were like, oh, there's all these people around the world. Oh, and look, there's a couple in New Zealand doing it. And, you know, you had all this really specific information to this country. It was so thorough and so just amazing. And so, you know, you were a massive, massive boost to us to actually even get into this whole world. So
it's been a long road and a beautiful road, and I love sharing it with you guys.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and I think that's something that's so great about the zero waste movement in New Zealand, at least, because that's what we have experience of. Is for us, it's much more like a whānau, and you have like the different generations, you know, you've got people like,
don't call me the mummy.
No, I wasn't. I was going to actually start with the grandfather, you know, like Warren Snow and Cliff 30 years ago. And then,
there's the Zero Waste Granny as well.
Zero Waste Granny, yeah. And you guys starting it, you know, what 2008, that's 12 years ago, the lifestyle. And lots of people don't realize that you started the same year as Bea Johnson, who's the internationally famous zero waste lady, but you guys started at the same time.
We were all talking to each other back in the day, actually, all swapping stories and stuff. But she's really carried on with that. I mean, here I am doing something quite different now. My learning edge, I like it shifting, you know. I've done zero waste and I still pretty much live zero waste, but I'm just out of all the podcasts we've done, I think soil is my favorite. I think I say that quite a bit because for me, that's my learning edge. I just couldn't believe what we found out when we were just like, what? You know.
But zero waste really is like a doorway into so many other issues.
It's a gateway drug.
It's a gateway sustainability drug.
And Liam's into soil. Like, it's kind of, it all comes back to it, really, isn't it?
Something else then. Hey, so individual action is connected to systemic issues.
Yes.
Can one of you legends just, for our the sake of us all, remind us what a systemic issue is?
Well, I guess it's just looking at the whole of our world's waste issues and, you know, just the sheer quantity, you know, the way that our waste management system works, you know, how New Zealand ships waste and recycling overseas and where that goes and what other countries do and how we import food and what packaging it comes in, you know, that whole systemic
thing.
That
you know, looking big.
And yeah. you know, yeah.
So, and yeah, and even bigger than that, like it's not even just waste, like waste itself is a symptom of systemic issues. So thinking about the way that we use resources and the way that we use energy and the governments and businesses behind all of those things. And yeah.
So it's even bigger again. It's this momentum that humanity's had in our system is really based on growth.
Yes.
And where this generation is transitioning or needs to transition to a system based on something perpetual.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That idea of, you know, consumption drives economic growth and
that's what we're talking about, decoupling, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So there's three big players. This is how I always think of it. And I love, this is my favorite conversation. the relationship between the power and that the businesses have, after all, they're the ones that make all of the crap and the good stuff and the bad stuff, and we buy it, and pretty much everything we do is based around consumption. Not a heck of a lot of us growing stuff and not buying stuff. So business is so powerful. Then you've got your government, obviously framing everything, dictating a lot or not. And then you've got your individuals. And these three are often set up against each other. And there's so many conversations people have around who should be taking the lead, who does have the truest power. So that's kind of the seat of our conversation today, isn't it? To look at, as individuals, are we powerful or not? Where does it sit? And are we guilty or not? Are we, you know, how vested should we be feeling?
You know, part of the answer to that, or not the answer, but part of the conversation is that with a systemic issue, you've got multiple players involved in the problem. And so the solutions have to happen on multiple levels at the same time.
And collaboratively.
Yeah. So it's not really about just whether individuals have the responsibility or just businesses or just government. We actually need change on all levels, and we also need to do it quite quickly to really turn the ship around. And often when we come back to these conversations about whether individual action is even worth it, you know, these things aren't mutually exclusive. We do need change on all levels, but perhaps the responsibilities of course are different and so on, but we can't have change without, you know, with only one part moving.
Shane Ward said that well too when he was for Better Future Forums. He was on the podcast a few weeks ago saying that you need, because I think I probably pitched a similar question, and he said you really need top down and bottom up at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting one, this one of our sense of power, because if we don't believe we have it, we won't exercise it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I kind of wonder if it goes back to, I mentioned earlier, you know, it was in the 50s and 60s when this whole hyper-consumerist society started to become the norm, and then all the waste started to appear, and governments started trying to do something about it, and then big campaign from sort of plastics companies and packaging companies was, well, it's individuals who are littering who are the problem. It's not the materials, it's the individuals are the problem. So in a way, it was like you have to take individual responsibility and individual action. But, you know, whatever, 70 years later, the mess is so much worse. So it's kind of almost feels like, well, individual action didn't work, did it? And so maybe there's something in that which is like disempowering for, you know, that we've been told we have to take individual action in this way, but it hasn't worked at all. So,
but interestingly, you know, the impact of individual consumption we can see, you know, in terms of the negative impact, like if individuals couldn't make a difference, then how are we in this mess in the first place?
Oh, yes. Sing it, sister.
but in terms of that conversation about the individual litterers, I think what's really important and what needs to be detangled, and it's actually crucial, is that there has been a co-option of the concept of individual responsibility, because we live within a very neoliberal framework in the modern age, where it's very easy for businesses to individualize responsibility for a systemic problem, and that distracts attention away from manufacturers and so on. So when we talk about the there's a difference between individual responsibility and individual empowerment, I suppose, and we have to be careful that we don't. It comes back to that conversation of how change needs to happen on all levels. So if we're just individualizing responsibility, then what we're not seeing is change on a business and a government level, and then that's bad. So it's how do individuals fit in within that bigger change narrative, but not making individuals solely responsible for fixing a problem that is caused by multiple actors on multiple levels.
So it's kind of simple in a way, isn't it? It's saying that individuals must be a part of this. Without the individual action, the changes that government and businesses can make is just not going to be enough, and it's not going to be enough to shift that systemic platform that we're on. Having said that, just because it's a crucial, pivotal part doesn't mean that it's the leading or spearheading part. Like each of these, you know, the government and the businesses and consumers, we're all actually needing to spearhead together.
Again, it's not anyone's responsibility. It's not individuals or governments or businesses' responsibility to lead.
That togetherness is really key.
Yeah.
So how, I'm interested in where, like, some personal stories, I guess, like how this belief system that you have, that the individual action is crucial and powerful. How has it filtered through into your own lives and your own choices?
Like, I have really strong feelings around that, because some of my background is in law and policy, and really early on in my studies I was doing lots of interning, and I was interning at Oxfam New Zealand on their climate change campaign. And this was back in 2009, and was really at the pointy end of kind of the policy, trying to get New Zealand, I think it was just before the Copenhagen Agreement, and trying to get New Zealand to agree to X amount of reduction by this time. And so much work and research going into the position and so on. And then we went into this big meeting with Nick Smith, was in charge at the time of the minister. And there were hundreds of people in this room, all getting to come up to a microphone and, you know, express what we felt about where the target should be set and so on and so forth. And there was just this lineup of ministry officials, and everybody sort of listened. And then he sort of nodded and sort of take it on board. And then they went and they set a sort of target that didn't even match with the science. And that was like my first experience of, wow, that was a lot of energy and time for an outcome that was, I may as well not have done anything. And then started, after my degree, was working in with NGOs doing policy stuff, and also within government, within both parliament and judiciary, and just seeing the institutional inertia that, you know, people might go into these institutions, be really passionate or even not that passionate, and you'd have really great information going to people, but the decisions just didn't translate. And you'd see the activists like fighting and no change. And I just got fed up, honestly. And I was just like, I feel so disempowered by this whole experience that for me, the only way to get a sense of empowerment back and a sense of hope was to say, well, what can I control? And I can control my own life and my own decisions, and I can spiral out from there. So rather than like being this dot that's trying to influence this other dot 5K down the road, I'm actually just going to start with myself and spiral out and sort of be the change. And
so that was where the impetus for Rubbish Trip came from. And
well, that's where the impetus for lifestyle change and me valuing that came from. Yeah. And then it was a lot further down the track before we got into zero waste, but it was kind of all this logical progression. Yeah, I'm not sure how Liam transitioned to that.
Yeah, I don't know. I was sort of naturally ready for it, but I can't say I've really sort of thought about it deeply on that sort of level. But one thing which I keep coming back to is that really amazing thing about waste, or I don't know if it's amazing, but is just how tangible it is and how visible and you know, how, you know, most people, whatever their backgrounds, whatever their political beliefs or whatever, agree that waste is a problem, and that litter and plastic pollution is a problem, and that it's so visible that we can see what to do about it, you know.
Mm.
We
can see. As opposed to carbon.
Exactly. Mm. And so, you know, there was
acidification.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. How do you, on an individual scale, how do you impact that? And how do you measure that? How do you actually, because that's the big thing about the empowerment of individual action is you can see that you are making a difference. And so
that's why zero waste is the gateway, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's this tangible
absolutely
thing.
So that was a big thing for us, was just seeing. I mean, there was that wonderful photography exhibition of called 7 Days of Garbage, where it's, you know, a whole
Greg
bunch of different
Segal.
Yeah, a whole bunch of different families in the US who were just asked to keep their waste for 7 days and then chuck it on the ground and lie in it and have photos
yeah,
taken of
that,
them.
Yeah.
And it's just so tangible. It's like, that's my stuff that I've produced over the week. So I can see, well, how do I
reduce it? Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting, eh? So there's something for you around the tangibility of an action that you could see that you're making a difference. And then something for you, Hannah, around this reaction to the institutional inertia, to use your phrase.
And sense of
control. Yes, yeah, which I think I can relate to both of those stories, actually. And for me, it was very simple. For me, I was just taking on board this information globally as I became aware of environmental problems and feeling smaller and smaller, and then not having a skill set, actually. I found really, really hard. So I was no longer wanting to make the choices that I was making just to feed myself and clothe myself, but I did not know how to shift it. Mm. And so it was really disempowering. And so discovering zero waste and a community of people that could help me shift those habits was empowering. And it's that empowerment that has led me to be able to take other steps.
Yeah, yes. And I think that's really interesting, because one thing we do hear quite a lot when we go and do talks in workplaces, it's less so when we do our public ones because the audience is very self-selecting, but if we go into a workplace, we're sort of in front of some people that might not have, you know, otherwise come, and there'll be this, well, what's the point of me going to all this effort? There's only so many hours in the day. If I want to make a real difference, I should focus the time I have on getting change from the top, from government and businesses. And that's all well and good, but if you only have so many hours in the day, our personal experience is that you can get so much done so much faster in your own life because you've got so much control than you could ever achieve trying to, you know, like, what are you going to do? Sign a petition, you know, in terms of...
Whoa, now we're getting to that.
But the other part of that is, and it's kind of relates to what you said, is that when you start to make these changes in your own life and just figure out, like, how am I going to live without waste? Mm. Very quickly, you do, through practical experience, gain so much more understanding about what needs to change at a systems level.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I find, like, for example, I think you and Matthew are a really interesting example. I often think about it because you guys... Well, from what you've told us, when you decided to live zero waste, you weren't really eco-minded at all. It was just like a thing you want. I think it wasn't even called zero waste then. It was like waste-free.
Well, there wasn't a term that we knew of. I think actually there was a term called zero waste, but we hadn't managed to find it through Googling. And that's why we called our challenge rubbish-free. Because it was just the language that we were using. Yeah.
And then as you're going, you know, like 10 years down the track, you know, you're really involved with community resource recovery networks. You're involved with, Matthew's running Envision New Zealand, which does waste consultancy. But it's not like you came to that through lifestyle change.
We did. Mm. Yes. It's interesting, isn't it? It's just so, I can't help but go back to this comment you made about the petition thing.
I didn't mean to sound derisory.
No, but it's like I think a lot of people start their journey in terms of sustainability with an awareness that they're not happy with how things are going for the planet. And so there's an opportunity to sign a petition. Great. That's one of the only ways they can think of, apart from perhaps taking out the recycling, that is really going to make a difference, and it does. But there's an awareness that is actually slowly dawning, I think, hopefully, on all of us, that it's our day to day. So signing a petition's great and obviously really needed, but we also really need a shared understanding of the you said it before too, the it's our consumption that's got us into this mess. So actually that is obviously a very, very powerful thing, if not the most powerful thing for us to be focusing on.
Yes. I think maybe I don't know if you wanted to talk about this later on, but
we'll talk about it now.
The takeaway throwaways campaign really for us encapsulates those different things.
So because, let's talk about what is the takeaway
throwaway campaign. Well, firstly, it's a petition, so we're all about petitions as well.
You've got the bases covered.
And it's a petition asking for the government to ban single-use serviceware, so that's cups and containers and cutlery and stuff like that. But on the other hand, mandate and help to co-design reusable schemes to put in place of the single-use stuff. So it's, you know, banning, but also providing an alternative, because there needs to be an alternative. And that's the core of the campaign. But recognizing that, you know, we can't just wait for the government, you know, businesses and individuals have to take actions too. Our website is totally full of resources, FAQs for, you know, there's a hospitality FAQ. What can hospitality businesses do right now to phase out single-use cups? What alternatives currently exist? There's one about for events and festivals. You know, what options are there for reusable cup schemes? And, you know, even a giant stadium with 30,000 people, what can they do? And then there's a whole page on what individuals can do.
Brilliant.
We work with Laura from Yuyo, who's absolutely amazing, and she's a social media whiz, and she's just pushing it all the time, like who's doing what, sharing wins around the country, what cafes are doing what individuals have come up with really innovative solutions. And it's just this amazing kind of dynamic, you know, working towards this goal, which is also calling on the government to do something, you know? So it's like the community and individuals and businesses are all doing this work in the meantime with what's available and what we can come up with our creativity.
Brilliant.
In order to...
How do people find Takeaway Throwaway?
Our website, takeawaythrowaways.nz. All the information is there. You can sign the petition there. But we're also on Instagram, Facebook. So that's how you can find it.
Brilliant.
So I think petitions are a really important part of individual action, because it speaks to systems, isn't it? Like, you're signing a petition to invite the government to do something.
It's giving mandate.
Yeah.
Who said that recently? I've really cottoned on to it. It's without, probably you guys, without that mandate, the government's hands are tied. So it's like we've got to meet them there every step of the way. You know, and it's through the campaigning and the petitioning that we're giving, that's kind of almost, it's not like we're, it's quite a different mindset to saying we're angrily trying to convince this oppositional government to something. It's shifting it around and saying we are creating an environment where you're able to do the stuff that you probably want to do anyway.
Absolutely.
That mandate doesn't come just from the petition. And in fact, I'd say the mandate comes much more strongly from the businesses and the communities and the individuals starting to live the alternative. So the government can see only you want us to do this, but actually
let's facilitate this thing that's happening.
It's like when the supermarkets started phasing out single-use plastic bags on their own. And then the government was like, oh, sweet, they've got it. Okay, cool, we'll ban them. You know, like, it's like, unfortunately, we are in this situation where governments, I think it's not even a lack of mandate. It's also like a lack of time and resources to work out what the alternative is. Like, government actually doesn't want to come up with the alternative. They want someone else to. And then they'll be like, sweet, that's fine.
Yeah. So I think such a big part of this is about normalizing it. Like, it's just stuff we do every day, because at the end of the day, the people in government, the people at CEOs
they're people, right? Coffees.
Exactly. They go to cafes and
I'm pretty sure they do.
Yeah, but we hope so. Hope they're not robots who don't. Yeah. I mean, they can drink tea if they want, but, you know, coffee's fine too. But, you know, and we actually saw this. It was a really interesting example during the lockdowns and the alert levels in New Zealand, where alert level 4, everything locked down really quickly. And then we had to quickly decide what were essential businesses or not. And in the grocery space, that meant virtually all of the places that people would normally shop to get low waste groceries. So independent grocers, bulk stores, butchers,
Farmers markets. Anything like green swap.
Yeah. They were initially, you know, closed down. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we sort of feel like if it was normal that people understood, you know, that's kind of the kind of consumption that we really need to have a more sustainable society, then they probably wouldn't have been shut down, you know? They would have been seen as essential because, you know, they are essential.
Remembering that, you know, there was this other argument that, oh, well, they're not hygienic, but actually, you know, those, again, are assumptions that aren't based on anything concrete. So when you have it normalized that everything's in a little packet, you just assume that that's the safest, most hygienic way of doing things. But in actual fact, if you analyze things a little bit further, a zero waste store can be made to be just as safe, if not more safe. But it's just the assumptions that you're, you know, your baseline starting point, you're not going to adapt those systems to work for COVID-19 because you've already presumed that the normal way of doing things is the supermarket way. So, yeah, it does go to show that when things aren't normalized, you just don't give them a chance to, to carry
normal's
on.
Normal's pretty powerful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And actually, that I'm going to segue a bit, if that's cool with you guys.
Yeah.
Speaking of normal, something that seems to be more normal in this sphere is women's involvement. And it's not as common, is it, for the blokes to be... I mean, if it's a bit techie, I think they're usually there, or eco-building or stuff. Classic,
yeah.
Hey?
Oh, yeah.
But, you know. But, Liam, I'm really interested because you are a fantastic role model. You're right in the space. You're really vocal. Can you give us a comment on men in this space?
Yeah, it was something became more and more interested in as we started doing the rubbish trip, and then we started looking at our Facebook, you know, statistics of who our fans and followers and stuff were, and it was
a bit of a female slant.
Yep, 88%.
Wow,
female.
It's 20% to 40 male. Bracket as well, eh?
Yeah. Yes, and that was reflecting what we were seeing at our presentations as well. Like just visually, we could see that our audience was predominantly female, and there was very few men who would turn up.
It's like a yoga class.
Yeah,
20 to 40, 88% woman.
Yeah, so you know, I got really interested in why that was, because you know I'm interested in it, and why, you know, it doesn't feel like it's a gender issue for me. And I did a bit of research, and I wrote a blog post about it last year. And in my research, there had actually been studies of gender attitudes to environmental issues and environmental consumption choices as well, and found that men were much more likely to make a purchasing decision based on whether it reflected their masculinity or not, their gender identity. And so if they were given the choice of, like, you know, an electric car or, a grunty, you know, diesel car or whatever, they'd go for the less environmentally friendly choice because it was perceived to be masculine. They were much more concerned looking, you know, maintaining their identity, their external.
Well, hang on, maybe women are just as concerned with that, but don't feel like they have to choose. Maybe they're feeling like the more feminine choice is often that more eco-friendly choice.
The study showed that...
Or are men more insecure?
Yeah,
well... Because it wasn't just to do with environmentalism, right? The study showed women were more likely to not care about the perceived gender.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, like, if it's a pink razor blade or a blue razor blade, a woman isn't going to...
care to the
according to this study.
Okay, that was so that was the study, and then so there was a few sort of recommendations, I guess, or like suggestions of like how do we think about this, and how do we maybe get more men involved in this space and stuff like that. And you know, some of the suggestions were like, well, maybe we need to try to market some of the greener options, you know, and masculine colors and sharp edges and you know all this kind
of
stuff.
I think, to be fair, there is a slight feminization of a lot of the eco stuff.
I'm
not seeing the sharp clean line so much. There's lots of spirals and things.
Absolutely. And that's something I haven't really it's true.
Okay,
it's,
those no, damn I, spirals.
Yeah, not for me, thanks. No. But that's something I haven't really worked out is that what's the chicken and egg situation with that? Like, is that because there are, you know, 80%+ women involved in this movement, and that's what's being put out there, or is it? So I don't know. It's a It's a really tricky one. And
then there's also the question of, but why is environmentalism feminized in the first place? You know, like, why is it perceived to be a feminine? Like, it could be the chicken and egg thing. Or is it like really stereotypical assumptions that, you know, if you care about the environment, you're more caring and you're more nurturing. And that's, you know, but it's all stereotypes.
I don't see what is feminine about wanting, like, you know, clean air and healthy food and good water to drink so that we're, you know, not sick and, you know, our kids actually have a nice world to live in. You know, that's something we all want, right? It's there's nothing masculine or feminine about that. And so I think having male role models who actually just show there is nothing. Yeah, I don't know. It's such a tricky one. Like, we don't want to reinforce that those stereotypes.
Not at all. Charles Einstein's an interesting guy, in terms of, so author, written a few bestsellers, including the only one I've read, which is More Beautiful World, Our Hearts Knows Possible. Longest book title ever. And he talks about the need, and coming back to our conversation around power of individual action, he talked a lot about that we actually just need to, yes, we can be doing the all of the various multitudinal little things, little tweaks that we need to be adopting, but it needs to come from a lens, a different lens, a different way of seeing the world.
I think like that the personal is political thing is quite important when you're thinking about individual action as a means of creating a new society. Because when you get to, say, going back to that thing about the neoliberalism and individualizing responsibility, a lot of the actions that are promoted are things like buying a nice fancy reusable cup, or buying, it's all sort of sustainable consumption.
Or more sustainable, probably.
Yeah.
Rather than sustainable.
Yeah,
but it's still about consuming things.
It is, yeah.
So it's sort of remarketing individuals as green consumers, whereas if you're thinking about trying to system change through individual lifestyle choice, you're more likely to be thinking about, well, how do I disrupt that consumption in the first place through my individual actions?
So you're saying that... if you're new to sustainability and you're trying to work this out, it's not just about how we consume differently. You're saying something quite radical here.
Yeah, well, I mean, my view on zero waste, and I'm sure Liam would be the same, but I will let you speak for yourself, is that one of the things it is fundamentally an anti-consumerist. Or I don't want to use the prefix anti, but, you know, it's not a consumerist way of being. It's really about thinking, how can I make do with what I have already, or on a systems level, what we already have as a society, to have the things that I need to have a good quality of life without needing to go out and buy things. Because that's part of the trap of the wastefulness, is that so many people are so busy struggling to make ends meet, and there's this whole narrative of convenience. And often convenience items tend to be quite wasteful, and they trap you into making lots of micro purchases all of the time, which overall costs more. Whereas if you sort of step back from that for a moment and think, well, how can I actually have all of this but without consuming things in that monetary sense?
Going back to the gender conversation too, seeing the role for individuals to actually move behavior at a systemic level, change how we do things systemically. You know, if for example you have, you know, rather than trying to market things to, you know, to those people who aren't necessarily interested in taking individual action, but actually having a farmer showing what's possible so that he can then influence other farmers, having a CEO, you know, doing something innovative and different in their industry that influences the other CEOs. And, you know, those are things that men can lead in and women can lead in as well. And it doesn't have to be reinforcing those stereotypes. And it's like an individual, they might be in a certain position. I mean, but it could just be any old farmer, any old CEO, whatever, any old staff member in a business, taking that action, influencing other people in their industry to get that system, well, to start a more systemic change.
There's so much here around the power of small actions, not just adding up, but more than that, cascading into something quite separate to the initial small action that is able to produce the systemic change that is needed. Is there any closing thoughts and remarks?
I think one thing that we always say about the value of individual action, particularly around environmental things like zero waste, is also trying to understand why some people might think that individual action isn't worthwhile. And often actually what underlies those ideas is something completely different to what people are saying. It's a fear of change. It's also a fear of having to do something that might be a perceived sacrifice when your neighbours aren't doing it. You know, like a fairness, it's not fair. And I think what we always try to communicate first and foremost is that for us, at these individual lifestyle changes, not only do they help us live in alignment with our values, not only do they make us feel more empowered, it's also improved our well-being and our life overall. And so we never really frame these individual actions as a sacrifice.
No. Yeah.
So it's got a political outcome, but it's also, it's beyond that. It's also, it's not a sacrifice. It's boosting our well-being and our connection to communities. And so we prefer to take, why wouldn't we take individual action, I guess, is the thing.
Yeah, it's a win-win.
And that's really where that disconnection or between the, you know, individuals and the systemic change comes from, I think, is that, you know, we wear that sort of, oh, it's not my responsibility, it's your responsibility, because it's not fair that it's all on me to do everything, comes from that place. Or, you know,
true, but because it's being framed as something negative,
yeah,
as opposed to actually this is a positive thing.
Why should I have to do it, you know? And I mean, there's lots of great memes that kind of encapsulate this idea really well, of, you know, like people at this UN meeting, like pointing at a slide that says we want cleaner air, better water, you know, healthier people, blah, blah, blah. And then someone's commenting, it's like, but what if we do all this stuff for nothing and it's untrue? You know, it's like, well, don't you want that anyway? You know, like that's a really positive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
it's like, we can't lose by doing this stuff.
Absolutely.
Because there is a lot of concern that, you know, changing, it's change is really hard when it's a lifestyle thing.
Yeah.
And that people feel time poor and financially poor. And so, you know, like there is something that's got to get you over that initial hump.
Yes, yeah.
And that's a faith that it will be worth it.
Yeah.
And for us, we really think it is. But, you know, there is a leap of faith at the beginning, and that's really hard.
Absolutely.
I'm going to finish with the words of Christy Lawson from
Earth Savvy.
Yeah. One of the many beautiful shout outs I didn't get a chance to read. Thank you for your extraordinary commitment, limitless energy and love for Papatua Nuku. Know that we are all so appreciative of all that you do. Big thanks and big love.
Right back at Christy. You, Christy.
Kia ora.
Kia ora, guys. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us, Waveney.
Pleasure.